Hello and welcome to the London Philharmonic Orchestra's Summer Podcast. I'm Edward Seckerson. The final concerts before the summer break at the South Bank Centre's Royal Festival Hall are in early July. And with a world premiere of a symphony by the legendary Indian composer Ravi Shankar, as well as celebrations for the 350th anniversary of the Royal Society, the UK's Academy of Science, it's a great way to end the season. Music by Philip Glass is the constant in these concerts, and on the 1st of July, Ravi Shankar's symphony is preceded by Glass's 1986 violin concerto. The soloist is fellow American Robert McDuffie, who's become closely associated with Glass's music over recent years. Earlier this year, McDuffie brought us the European premiere of Glass's second violin concerto with the LPO. And I took the opportunity to talk to him about performing one of the most recognisable music voices of the 20th and 21st centuries. You've called Glass the American Vivaldi. I guess you're referring to the style of writing and the nature of the arpeggiations and all that kind of technical stuff.
The chugging ostinatos, yeah. The pleasant melodies up top, the repetition, not the formulaic repetition that the Glass has become famous for. But I certainly do see a lot of similarities. I'm certainly not immune from making some grand sweeping statements about my profession, and I actually called Vivaldi the world's first minimalist. That may or may not be true, but it's pretty close.
The Glass requires incredible stamina. What might sound easy to the innocent ear in terms of repetition, these, as you say, these chugging ostinati, etc. But to get the variations in colour and texture that are necessary to make the music really interesting and to make it develop must be a real challenge.
Challenge is exactly the right word. You know, I was part of a group, again, of Juilliard hotshots who loved to make fun of people like Philip Glass in school. He was the butt of many jokes. We were just ignorant. We didn't really know his work. It's very easy to copy his structure, his formula, but it's the DNA inside that makes him especially unique and special and even genius. I certainly didn't know that as an immature kid. And when the idea of recording Philip's first concerto combined with John Adams' violin concerto came up, I was talking about it with Telarc, my record company at the time, and they loved the idea, and I said, well, maybe I should listen to a recording. And Gidon Kremer had just put out a recording with the Vienna Philharmonic, and I remember sitting on the floor in my den drinking a glass of wine with my wife, and we couldn't speak afterwards. It was so seductive and manipulative in the best sense of the word. It took us to a different place. And, of course, I said, I just cannot wait to learn this. I just cannot wait. So the first concerto has been successful for me as an artist. I love playing it. I'm still playing it a lot.
What is most difficult about it to crack?
It's not as well orchestrated as his second concerto. The first concerto is very heavily orchestrated with a full orchestra with tuba and trombones and trumpets and everything, and sometimes hard for the violin to cut through. I've actually used a microphone on some occasions, which at the end of the day just doesn't work. I tried it, so we try to bring down the orchestration as much as we can. To me, it still works live beautifully if the orchestra is down and playing dynamics that are not written on the page.
The second concerto, which is entitled The American Four Seasons, was written for you. Now, did this come out of your devotion, your dedication to performing the first concerto?
About 8 years ago, many things happen either in the shower or while you're lying in bed, and I had not performed the Vivaldi Four Seasons yet. Always loved the piece. Of course, everybody had done it. What am I going to bring new to the piece? Why does an American violinist from Macon, Georgia want to, you know, bring out the Vivaldi Four Seasons when it's the most recorded piece of all time? So instead of just asking my manager to contact orchestras and say McDuffie wants to play Vivaldi Four Seasons, I mean, why not make it meaningful and relevant? And what about asking Philip to write an American Four Seasons and pair it with the Vivaldi Four Seasons and take it on tour and see what happens? So I secured an audience with Philip. I remember well. It was the summer of 2002. It was right before he was about to embark on these film scores for The Hours and The Fog of War. But I said, I think you're married to Vivaldi. I hope you're not offended by that. He said, no, I'm absolutely honored. That's wonderful. He was immediately excited about it. And we were talking about whether we should follow Vivaldi's sonnets or should he look to a poet that he admires. He said, Ginsberg, we have to go with Ginsberg. But he was excited from the very beginning. I just didn't know that other projects had to fall in place before mine came around. But I believed him. He looked right into my eyes and said, we're going to do this.
And was he happy to have your input as well? I mean, were you in some way involved in the compositional process?
Well, I was. I specifically asked for four large movements, originally thinking that we would be naming the movements as seasons until we both disagreed on what was summer and what was winter. And he said, this is a great opportunity, actually. I said, why don't we just leave it up to the audience to decide what the season is? Why throw it out to them and just make it so easy? I mean, if you think that the second movement is winter, if I think it's summer, isn't this a great opportunity just to leave it up to the audience? And anyway, it gets them off the hook. It's the slow movement, which is quite poignant and beautiful, and I just thought of icy cold beauty. And he thought of gentle winds, summer winds, with people lying on the grass with the sun. And the only thing I asked is that it had synthesizer instead of harpsichord. I wanted the original, the indigenous rock and roll Philip Glass that turned David Bowie on. So much of his music ends so softly and fades out, where people are just lost in thought. And I said, I really want, I hope I can use this phrase on the air, I want a kick-ass rock and roll ending. He said, great, what a great idea, let's do that. And then he kind of added a bonus. It's a major piece, but we do have the four large movements, but he introduces each movement with a solo violin, not really cadenza, but four songs that introduce each movement, so that it's a continuous experience.
What do you say when, because you must travel, you travel the world playing these pieces, and you probably get confronted by people who think Glass is facile, Glass is whatever they say. What is your response to that? You've talked about his DNA being rather complicated, but what is your response to the
great? A lot of that is, the ones who criticize him seem to like to hear themselves speak at a dinner party or at a bar or behind the scenes when we talk, and some of it is, I think, showmanship on their part. But all I can do is just point to what audiences, how audiences react, and even my fellow musicians on stage. It is true, and Philip will be the first to admit this, first rehearsals of Philip Glass are tedious. A lot of repetition, they don't know it yet, they're not totally brought in, sucked in yet, as I call it. But I noticed this with the first concerto, and I certainly noticed it in Toronto when I played the world premiere in December, is that the musicians are proud of it. And they're proud of what they're doing, and they know that something special is happening on stage. So my response is, he is the most unique living composer today. You do know that it is Philip Glass when you're hearing it, but when you listen even closer, you hear the subtleties. It's the DNA that I speak about. Only Philip Glass can fill in those parameters. There's nobody else who can do that, and that's what sets him apart.
Robert, teaching is obviously very important to you, and you have your McDuffie Center for Strings in your hometown, Macon, Georgia. And tell us why that's important, and what your vision is for young musicians.
Thank you for bringing that up. There are too many conservatories, too many schools of music, and I certainly didn't want to start one that would just be another conservatory. Several things played into this. This is my hometown. I live in New York. I still love Macon. So when Mercer University, which is the university in Macon, it's a private Baptist-affiliated school with about 8,000 students, they wanted to put music on the map from Macon, and they asked me what it would take, and I said, that's almost impossible, but let's try to figure out something that would be meaningful again to the students and put Mercer on the map. Because it was affiliated with a liberal arts college, I came in with a very ambitious agenda, got a lot of people mad with me. I decided to have an Institute for Strings. I'll cap it at 26, 12 violins, 6 violas, 6 cellos, 2 double bass, taught by the major musicians, but not just any musicians, musicians who have their own festivals, who have their own quartets, who have their own performing careers, and also leaders of major orchestras, to teach a comprehensive string curriculum, but at the same time to form a new curriculum that's never been done before called a Bachelor of Musical Arts, which would focus on subjects, accounting, business, arts management, IT literacy, creative writing, that would prepare the entrepreneurial musician for the real world. Mm-hmm. We're only in our third year. We have 19 students already. Something really nice is happening in a little town of Macon, Georgia.
Finally, Robert, your constant companion, and I'm talking about your violin now over there. Tell us about it.
Well, it is a violin made in 1735 in Cremona, Italy, by Giuseppe Guarnieri. I fell in love with it in the mid-90s, and unfortunately it cost quite a bit of money back then, but I thought I could go to Southern Banks and convince them to buy a violin for me. Of course, after several false starts and talking to people a lot smarter than I, we came up with the idea of forming a limited partnership whereby investors would buy shares in the violin. We basically copied an aircraft leasing agreement and substituted the word violin instead of aircraft.
That's amazing.
We had 16 investors, and I'm able to play the violin for 25 years, and then we sell it when I turn 65. It's the first time I'd played a violin where I didn't feel I was running with a pulled hamstring. I can really do anything I want. I can pull out the sound I want. And even when I barely put pressure on the bow, the sound really carries. And I've never had a magical experience like that.
As part of the Royal Society's See Further Festival, exploring links between the sciences and the arts, the London Philharmonic Orchestra will be giving 3 performances on the 3rd and 4th of July of a brand new work by Philip Glass. Based on a children's book by physicist Brian Greene, Icarus at the Edge of Time is a futuristic reimagining of the classic Greek myth, which explores deep space and the awe-inspiring mysteries of a black hole. With specially created visuals and narration, this work is bound to prove intriguing. Don't forget, you can find out full details of all concerts and recordings on the orchestra's website, www.lpo.org.uk, or join in the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Recordings. The recent release of Brahms' first and second symphonies with Vladimir Yurovsky has been chosen as June's Disc of the Month in the BBC Music magazine. Praising Yurovsky's vibrant Brahms, his lightness of touch and fluidity of expression, reviewer Stephen Johnson says of the second symphony, "If you can't imagine Brahms being playful, go straight to the finale. A valuable reminder, amongst other positives, that Brahms revered Haydn." June, the new release on the LPO's own label is from the archive, recordings made at a concert in 1984 to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Elgar's death. It was conducted by the late lamented Vernon Handley, a man whose unobtrusive, unshowy manner belied an extraordinary understanding of and connection to the wide range of music he conducted. Todd Handley, as he was widely known, something to do with his early days as a toddler, was a tireless champion of British music, recording a huge legacy, much of it with the London Philharmonic Orchestra. On this release, Elgar's majestic First Symphony is paired with Sea Pictures, five exquisitely orchestrated songs of the sea, full of wistful longing, and sung by a lady who came to make them her own, Dame Janet Baker. Her famous studio recording with Sir John Barbarolli is a gramophone classic, but I'd go so far as to say that the added charge of a live event gives Dame Janet's performance an even greater drama and immediacy. I leave you with part of Where Corals Lie, Elgar's subtle orchestral colouring at his most exquisite. Thanks for listening.